launch pad, and someday down the road have the second stage, which is more complicated because that will be on much faster, much higher. It will require a huge seal to deorbit, find out where it is, to eventually bring that back to the launch site. Reusable, and of course the Dragon itself will be reusable up to 10 different times. Dragon someday down the road, they've already passed a lot of milestones, will hopefully within 4 years. SpaceX, you've got a flight on the 19th of September.
Maven and the SpaceX, boy, they're doing very well. They got a very nice track record I know that Paul's got a question for you, so go right ahead, Paul. Here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. You know who you are. We got it, John.
I used to know who I was. KC2WGB. Yes, I'd like to know if Paul has heard. It seems that last week I read an article about NASA has been working on developing carbon fiber fuel tanks, which are going to save a tremendous amount of weight. I'd like to know if Paul has any information on that and how far they have gotten. From what I understand, they've achieved some kind of success in either the shape or the structure, and it's supposed to give them more operating capabilities. Back to you, Dick.
And I'm going to make a guess here that there's carbon in this carbon. The carbon fiber, graphite-reinforced things like the rudder on the 767 aircraft that crashed into Queens, Flight 587. That's one kind of carbon. As we get better and better in producing carbon nanotubes, which are super strong by comparison, I guarantee this is going to be a continuously changing technology. So go ahead on carbon tanks, Paul. WS2N, a space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You know, they've been in development for many years. They want to, the goal is to lighten everything. And look how far Sierra Nevada has come with Dream Chaser. In fact, they ran tests out in California last week. They've got this thing suspended from a plane, and they're flying it up, you know, checking the aerodynamics of it. And by the end of the year, they'll be dropping this thing, and it'll be landing in the same airfield that the space shuttle was actually landing in not too many years ago. All made of carbon fiber, Travis. Probably the only part that's not going to be made, of course, the frame and the ablative shield, you know, for reentry, which will be replaced as a hole instead of thousands of little tiles like the space shuttle had. And that's a Dream Chaser. That, again, will launch people probably within about 3 or 4 years on top of an Atlas rocket. And it's got to be, you know, that carbon fiber has to withstand the strain of launch. It's going to be sitting on right on top of an Atlas V rocket, not on the side of it like the space shuttle. So at least it won't be affected by ice coming off and crashing into the wings at all. And basically, carbon was the wings of the space shuttle. That was not even metal. Of titanium, or anything they call it, carbon. And, you know, you can't take a direct hit of something. It'll blow a hole right through it. You drop it. But it's very good at, you know, sustaining heat, pressure, and developing tanks. Right now, a lot of tanks are still being brought in by the Russians. They've got these lithium tanks that are made, that's what they're made out of. Extremely light, reliable, and a lot of companies here. There are a lot of companies building space rockets, and they use the tanks that they're using. A lot of them are being imported from the Russians. So hopefully they'll get these carbon type or composite type of tanks to the point where they can compete against the Russians and have lighter tanks. And, you know, a lot of things have to happen. Every time they have an upgrade, it has to be not only lighter, it has to be better. They went through all of that with the strength of the external fuel tanks of the shuttle. They brought those things down 6,000 pounds or something, right? By using different types of metal to reinforce the external fuel tanks. So, but in passing the tests, they needed not only to be lighter, they needed to be stronger, better, and through with these new tanks that NASA's developing. They need them for the SLS, the Space Launch System, which will be taller, more powerful than the Saturn V rocket that took off people to the moon. So they've got a few years out to get these things developed. First launch of the SLS will be in 2017, so four years down the road, John, they should have these things operational. Back to you, Dick.
35, Paul. Very good copy. Out of curiosity, Paul, your last set of transmissions compared to 3 minutes ago before John asked his question, I see a very slight change in your audio, a little bit less bass. Did you change rigs, or is it my imagination? WS2N, KQLIW?
All I do is move the antenna a little bit, Dick. I'm picking something up from somewhere else and hit the mod or something. But all I do is, you talked about problems. I made an adjustment, and that's pretty much it. And by the way, anybody wants to contact me, somebody left me a nice story about a blog with the astronaut with the water in his suit problem and how extremely dangerous that really was. I mean, he wrote about this for public information. And if you read about it, I mean, this guy couldn't even see. He was left out there alone. He lost communications. Chris, his partner, was working. Thinking, he's okay. He's not in that bad of shape, putting things away. Meanwhile, this guy was wondering if he was going to really make it back to the Quest Lab. Anybody wants to contact me, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to that.
Spacenetreport@gmail.com. So, John, let me make sure you got all the information you were looking for from Paul. KC2WGB, KQRIW, and the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I did. And that's complete good information. Back to you, Dick.
They've got the shell of these tanks, or part of it already built, and that is made out of aluminum, so I'm not sure what the inside part is going to be, if that's going to be carbon or not, Dick. That's the goal, to make them all carbon.
Very fine, Paul. And NASA's doing some great things. And John and I both get emails. Half of our emails are on the subject of, it's about time somebody really explained to me in easily understand language what NASA is doing, what's going on in space. I guess it was yesterday, quite a few of us were meeting on this machine at 7:30-ish. And we're passing back and forth information about the International Space Station passing over. A real good pass took place at 8:13 yesterday, followed by an Iridium flash, the Iridium communication spacecraft, and so on. Both John and I went outside and looked, and a great big black cloud went exactly in the spot where I wanted to see the International Space Station, so I didn't see it. A number of other people did. Let me pass it back to John, because maybe he heard a little bit more about the successes of those who were on last night, passing that information back and forth that was started, I think, by Dave into APG, who quite often keeps track of what heavensabove.com, I think it is, or .net, one or the other. You go there and you type in your address, and they'll tell you what there is in space for you to see. That will be a direct overhead pass, and some of it's very exciting. How many of the people were successful last night at seeing the space shuttle or the Iridium flash or whatever from your recollection, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
.com, by the way.
Thank you. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Quite a few, Dick, on Long Island. Richmond here, we were pretty well socked in. I saw the original pass, which happened at, I think it was 8:11, which was 3 days ago. And then it had some repetitive transitions across. I didn't see anything else but that one. But out in Long Island, I know Andy, N2HUH, he saw a couple of passes, and I believe Don did also. quite a few people were looking. I didn't hear anyone who saw the iridium flare. I don't know if you did, Dick. I was totally blacked out here.
Yeah, I got busy in something else and didn't look for the iridium flash. And that iridium flash, by the way, was supposed to be, was at a -5 magnitude, some huge number. The brightest thing in the sky is -1 magnitude, which is the star Sirius. I'm not counting Venus or the moon. But I think it was supposed to be something like a -5 for the Huntington area for the iridium flash. Does that sound right, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, some people were saying over 7 also in different areas. I'm not quite sure why there's such a variance within a small distance, but I guess they must have that track pretty well square rooted, because they were giving out some very discrete numbers for each location, which you could find out on that website you mentioned. So, yeah, a lot of people had fun, and watching that thing travel, the one time I saw that the space station travel, it was moving beautifully, and I saw it for approximately a minute. A beautiful thing to see. Yes.
Very fine, John. I think somebody wants to sign in, ending with S. Who was that? Go ahead. I heard somebody by EchoLink trying to sign in, and I think I heard him ending with the letter S. Who was that? Okay, not hearing him right now. In the case of the space station, which is a very large spacecraft, I think you can easily say it is the biggest thing. I believe it has dimensions in the vicinity of the size of a football field. Am I correct on that one, Paul? If I look at the end-to-end dimensions, length, width, and diagonal dimensions, I think we're getting very close to the size of a football field when you include the solar panels on the International Space Station. Is that roughly true? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
It's a million times thick, and bigger than a football field. You got to include the end zone stick, and then we're good.
Okay, so it's not the whole stadium, but if I include the end zones of a football field, that's approximately the dimensions of the International Space Station, including its latest solar panel installation. Is that roughly true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what they say. It's in width, and it's actually wider, because you got the length about 300 feet, a little bit longer, and then you got the width, the layout of all those cylinders, all those modules, and they're probably about 200 feet.
So to answer your question, John, I've got a guess as to what's going on. I'm going to double check it with Paul. In the case of the space station, you've got a very large, very complicated object with all kinds of facets to the solar panels, the individual modules, the stuff like the alpha magnetic spectrometer hanging on the outside, all this stuff. You got a lot of individual bumps all over that thing. And the Soyuz spacecraft, a pair of them are attached to it, and so on. Ooh, a lot of stuff. So in the case of the International Space Station, when the geometry is right that it's going to fly over your house, and it does it at either sunrise or sunset, and left on 13 minutes after 8 last night, it was sunset. In other words, because they're 260 nautical miles above the surface of the Earth, the sun is shining on the International Space Station at the same time that you are in civil twilight, and maybe approaching nautical twilight. Civil twilight is when the sun is 6 degrees below your horizon. Nautical twilight is when it's 12 degrees below your horizon. And if the sun is 18 degrees below your horizon, that's called astronomical twilight. In other words, getting full darkness of the sky for an astronomer. So we were in at least civil twilight, maybe approaching nautical twilight on the Earth, but the sun is still shining on the International Space Station. And every so often, the path will be such that as it goes overhead to you, all of a sudden it goes into shadow and it suddenly winks out, if you know what I mean. So in the case of the space station, you're looking at a diffused reflection of a very complicated object. Let me drop. In the case of the Iridium communication satellites, they are much, much smaller than the International Space Station. And when the solar panels on the Iridium spacecraft are aimed just right, like a mirror, then you get a specular reflection off of that. And you know what it's like if you took a mirror out in the sunlight and you let the sun shine on your mirror and you flash it onto a tree that's across the yard that's in the shade, and you'll see a spot of light, a specular reflection spot of light, not a diffuse reflection. As such, the iridium will light up very specific areas on the ground, and you get a real bright specular flash in some particular area. And so, although I may have been getting a minus 5 or a minus 7 astronomical magnitude of light on that specular reflection from iridium down in Huntington, a person in Brooklyn at the same time is outside of that specular flashlight area of the mirror, if you know what I mean. Therefore, he sees a much less brighter situation. So it's two different kinds of reflection. That's my guess as to what's going on, John. Does that seem to make some sense? KC2WGB first, K2LIW in the deck net.
KC2WGB. Yes, the path that it traces out has got to be very small, you know, compared to the Earth. So it's just amazing, though, that it could be passing over your house. You're, I think, 40 miles from me, and that I may not be able to see it at all. But that space station was like a diamond. It has so many facets, I guess. It's just incredible the amount of sun that it reflects. I don't know if it's all polished aluminum or what it is, but it was extremely bright. But I do understand on the iridiums that they're dealing with a much smaller area, and it's only the solar cells that are reflecting that light down there. So, yeah, that makes sense. Back to you, Dick.
KC2MDP.
Go ahead, Steve.
Good evening, everyone. I got in late tonight. I just want to make everyone aware there is a very nice app for your smartphone. It's called ISS Detector, and it's put out by this company. It's RUNAR. I downloaded it several months ago, and I've had success the very first time I used it. You know, it gives you, you know, the time you'll be able to see it, the duration, the magnitude. It gives you all the information. It's a very nice app for anyone who's interested. Back to you.
That's awful good, Steve. Steve, you've been using it how long? How did you get a hold of it? Roughly how expensive is it? Sounds like you're pretty happy with it. KC2MDB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I've had it on my old phone, so I've had it probably for about 6-8 months. It's free, and just one day I was curious, because I think I heard on the TechNet, you know, you guys talking about you'll be able to see the International Space Station at a certain time, you know, in southwest sky or something. So just for the heck of it, I went to the phone, and, you know, went to the App Store there, and just pushed it, you know, typed in ISS Detector, and this came up. And I've been using it for a lot of months now, and I'm very, very happy with it. Back to you.
Glad to hear that, Steve. Sounds good. And I like the price, free. There used to be an expression somebody had for free take, for buy, waste time, or something like that. The price is right. Once again, if you're hearing things that you think shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode on your rig, listen to how strong the signal is. Please report it, giving us exact timing and how strong it was, to rfi@limarc.org. And it's sad that somebody thinks that that's the right thing to do, that he's getting pleasure out of that. For those who have known me in the past because they've talked to somebody that worked at the company that I worked at, most of those people, when you interview them, will probably say, yeah, this guy, K2RIW, is a bit of a character. But one of the things that quite often you'll hear is that, we certainly remember his physics puzzles. Some of those people were intimidated by it, but an awful lot of the people appreciated it. I've collected over the years about 35 physics puzzles. And my reason for collecting these physics puzzles is not to intimidate people, although some people make the misinterpretation and thinking I'm doing that just to intimidate them. You have to recognize the fact that you get yourself a good electrical engineering education in the United States, and you think that you're pretty well informed about what you need to do to carry on your business and to understand what Mother Nature is telling you. Let me drop.
About the ISS exit, WS2.
Go ahead, Paul.
He was right. The only problem I can't use, I tried it on my Kindle, and because the Kindle doesn't have a GPS on it, it doesn't work, and I don't have a smartphone, but it does work great. It's a great product. And for $1 or $2, you can get the upgraded version, and you can get amateur satellites when they're going overhead. They give you stuff like that. Back to you, Dick.
So if I understand correctly, Paul, you're also using ISS detector, that application for your portable electronic device that you carry. Yeah, go ahead.
I tried it. It didn't work, so I got rid of it. Because my portable device, the Kindle, does not have a GPS on it, so it doesn't know where I am. So, but I mean, so anybody that has, like Steve's smartphone or a tablet with a GPS, no problem. It works great. The upgraded version, you pay $1 or $2 for it, and you get amateur satellites as well.
Glad to hear that. All right, so you talk to people who have worked at the same company I have, and quite often people will say, one of the things I remember is this guy, K2RIW, Dick, was quite often asking us these physics puzzles. And my main motivation there is to recognize the fact that there's holes in the education we get. There are certain very important pieces of information that, for whatever reason, are not given to us. And is it just the education that we get in the United States? Not necessarily. When I had my conversations, quite often email conversations with XQ2FOD, Manfred Morningwig, very interesting character, who had this, in my opinion, very pivotal article in QST Magazine, December issue 1999, January issue 2000, on a switching power supply, a 12-volt switching power supply. I think was it 12 volts? Or was it 12 volts to 120-volt converter, an inverter? And anyhow, it was a 40-ampere, switching power supply. Very well done, very high efficiency. And so I started writing to him. He works for the European Southern Observatory in La Salina, Chile, is where he was working at the time. That is one of the world-class best optical astronomy installations on planet Earth. On top of a 10,000-foot high mountain in Chile is where there's a very significant optical astronomy satellite installation by the European Southern Observatory, a consortium of a whole lot of European countries, including the United States, finances that operation. He worked there, maintained that electronics, and also maintained some local repeaters that he set up for ham radio operations in the local mountains. Let me drop.
So, Steve, he said.
Okay, go ahead, Hal.
Yeah, I just want to mention, Dick, I was there at 8 o'clock. I was waiting till 9. There was so much dissertation going on. There were no questions and needed some answers. I was monitoring it from 8 to 9. That's not that I forgot about it. K6DPZ. I'm going to be QIT.
Okay. I'm going to put the great big mark. I'm going to put your mark, a favorable mark in the big book, that you were on site, ready to be queried for the so-called brief answers, and that you didn't see an opportunity where a brief answer was required, and you let me go on with my verbose answers. I'm not so sure you should have allowed that, Hal. I haven't confronted you, Hal. K6DPZ, thank you. K2RIW, back to you, Hal.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. I had a bailout at 9, and no questions were really asked before 9 that much. K6DPZ clear.
Dick, you're going to have to put a check on his Delaney card.
Yeah, we had some very good questions, Hal, from Dennis, NY2H, on how to get more hams into the hobby, which is one of your areas. We had some nice answers and questions from Al, KC2ZUM, on how to do 6-meter monitoring and so on. So There were lots of questions during that first hour. I'm not quite sure why you're saying there were no questions. I'll back you, Hal. I'll wait for the beeps.
Oh, no questions that were asked specifically. I wanted to be able to give a fast answer for. That's right. You were about 45 minutes into going over the whole dissertation of the TechNet.
Okay. Are you saying that my monologue in the beginning was 45 minutes long? Is that what you're saying, John? I mean, Hal?
That's what it was. John, were you? Did you listen to it? How long it took? It was about 45 minutes.
I didn't really clock it, but it's usually about 25 minutes. I didn't realize it was extended tonight. But if you were clocking it, then you've got the numbers.
Yeah, and then there were no real questions the last 15 minutes, and I had a commitment I had to take care of, and that's why I took off. But I took back on tonight just for you to know I was there. There would have been some questions that I could have given some fast answers on. I was ready to do it. But the monologue was too long, and nobody came in with the questions before the monologue at all.
Hey, Hal, I have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hal, about how many watts are you using? I hear you on the input as if you're right here on Staten Island. What an awesome signal.
That's 75 watts of failure at this time.
Okay, back to you, Dick.
So, once again, people will say that, for the two or three organizations I work for, they will say that this guy, RIW, has these puzzles. And some people really appreciate them. Some people are intimidated by them. My intention is not to intimidate. But I'm going to give you guys one of my puzzles tonight. And that is, what substance, what massive material is most important to you because you want to stay alive on planet Earth? You're living on planet Earth, and somebody says, of all the things you can choose, what to you is the most important substance to keep you alive? And now, how do you weigh it? I mean, how do you decide what's the most important? Does it weigh the most? Does it have the most amount of volume? Does it taste the best? Whatever. If you had to name a substance that's most important to you, what would be on the top of your list as the most important substance? I'm going to pass it over to you first, John, and then I'm going to pass it over to Nanette. Maybe you already know where I'm going, but KC2WGB for a quick answer. If you want, K2IW in the TechNet.
I would think water, Dick. That's off the top of my head without thinking much about it. I would say water. Back to you, Dick.
You're giving the answer that I think 90% of the population would give. I didn't say it's right or wrong. It's a darn good answer. Hal, if you're still there, what substance do you believe is most important to you? K60PZ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Hal got called away. Paul, WS2N, what substance to you is most important to maintain your life? Go ahead.
It's definitely water, because now I can drink it, I can make fuel out of it, and I can breathe it. Back to you, Dick.
Understand. So water is your answer. Anyone else want to give any other answer that's within the sound of my voice?
C2MDP.
Go right ahead, Steve.
I would have to say carbon.
Okay, Steve says carbon is the most important single substance that, you know, easily recognized substance. So carbon, other people have said water. Anyone else going to give an answer? Go right ahead with your call letters first. K2LIW.
KC2FYJ, I also would say carbon.
N2SLW.
N2RDB.
Okay, FYJ said carbon. N2SLW, what do you believe is the most important substance to you, sir?
Hydrogen that the sun's burning.
Another damn good answer. Without the sun fusing that hydrogen, all life in this solar system would not be there. Now, without a doubt, in the solar system, that is the most important substance. If you're now giving a second answer on planet Earth, what substance would you give N2SLW, K2LAW?
Dick, I came up with one answer. You need another one.
Yeah, you've given me the right answer in a global manner. In other words, if I'm looking at the whole darn solar system, you've given the answer. You go to the head of the class. But now if I restrict to just what's available to you on planet Earth, you're now going to give a second answer. What substance on planet Earth is most important to Mr. SLW?
I'll say oxygen, Dick. No one else has said oxygen.
Okay, and that's a very good answer. N2RDW, what substance on planet Earth do you think is most important to maintain your life?
N2RDB here. I would have said oxygen as well.
Okay, we've had a series of answers, and pretty good answers. Now, among the survivalists, the people who talk about what happens after a really major natural disaster, like, for instance, the earthquake that happened in Mexico City, 1985. The other earthquakes that have happened worldwide where buildings become collapsed on people and people get locked into some tiny little corner of the building. And some number of days later, as they start digging through the rubble, and they find the people who didn't survive. And you find out what was available to them, how long did they last, and what aided their survival. Among those survivalists that analyze that situation, let me drop. They use what they call the rule of threes. The rule of threes says you can live without air for 3 minutes. You can live without water for 3 days. You can live without food for 3 weeks. So 3 minutes, 3 days, 3 weeks is air, water, and food, in that order. Let's go back to that one called air that we all take for granted. Average human being breathes approximately 20 breaths per minute. Each breath takes in and exhales close to a liter of air. Liter is a volume as well as we usually think of a liter of soda, but it's a volume to the metric people. Roughly a liter of air per 20 minutes. Therefore, 20 breaths per minute, which happens to be around 20 liters per minute, 1,200 liters per hour, 28,800 liters per day of air. One of the other questions you can have a lot of fun with, I'm not going to ask you this question, I'm going to give you one of the puzzles I gave to Manfred Monhenweg, because he's working with a whole bunch of very high-powered scientists on top of this mountain in La Salina, Chile, at this world-class astronomy setup called the European Southern Observatory. Let me drop. Because most of those people were European educated, and I'm from the United States, supposedly United States educated, I wanted to know if there was a difference. So I asked him to ask his fellow people one of my puzzle questions, and that is, what is the mass of a cubic meter of air? The air that's in the room with you right now, 1 cubic meter of it, what does it weigh? In the United States, the average engineer gives an answer of 1 milligram. Some of them say 10 milligrams, but around that vicinity is what they give as an answer. The first question, of course, you're going to have is that how in the world do I weigh air? And the answer is you start off with a very strong steel box, 1 cubic meter of volume, put it on a scale, then you connect a vacuum pump, take out the air, and weigh it again. What will that difference be? The average engineer thinks it's somewhere between 1 and 10 milligrams. The answer is 1.2 kilograms, 2.7 pounds. Cubic meter of air is 2.7 pounds, 1.2 kilograms. Damn heavy stuff. You've got a life experience that tells you that. You remember when you were 8 years old, you stuck your hand out the window when the car was moving 50 miles an hour. Something damn heavy was hitting that hand. Do you remember that experience? How much force was on your hand when the air was hitting it at 50 miles an hour? That's a very strong piece of evidence as to how heavy air is. So that when you breathe in 28,800 liters of air per day, which is 28 cubic meters of air, you're breathing in 34 kilograms of air, 76 pounds of air per day flows in and out of your lungs. If you compare the weight of air that goes in and out of your lungs, 76 pounds of it per day, if I converted that to water, that would be 38 quarts of water. You try to consume...
Repeater, time out.
Just to make a weight comparison, you try to consume 38 quarts of water per day. You probably will not survive it. And by the way, a certain number of college kids every year die doing the hazing process for a fraternity because they run a competition as to who can drink the most amount of water in 20 minutes. Some of them die in the process of doing that. So fresh, clean, cool, sanitary water in excess can do all kinds of nasty things to your body and can kill you. So 38 quarts of water, no way. 76 pounds per day. If I take a look at the volume of my house, mine is a three-story, one-level ranch with a full basement. I've got around 1,800 square feet of area to my house with the full basement. Go through the mathematics. My house has got, 32,000 square cubic feet of air, 917 cubic meters. There's 2,400 pounds of air in my house. I breathe 76 pounds of air per day, which happens to be 27,000 pounds per year. I consume the air in my house, one human being, 13 times per year. Kind of amazing to me that air is that heavy and that much of it is going in and out of you continuously. So once again, 76 pounds of air per day goes in and out of your lungs. In every one of those breaths, if you want to think about it, let me jump.
Will you do TTT?
W2TTT, recognized. Gordon, I'll get to you in a second. Every one of those breaths you take, because all of those air molecules are completely recycled by Mother Earth, every one of those breaths you take contains some of those air molecules that were once inside of the lungs of every single adult human being that has ever lived on planet Earth, and maybe even some of the children, if you know what I mean.
And the dinosaurs.
I agree, and the dinosaurs. So, Gordon, there's a little more to the story, but go right ahead and add your part to it or ask your question. Maybe 2TTT, K2LIW in the tech man.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go into listening mode because I'm in a high spot up in Mahwah. I was on the Triboro before, by the way. I'm up in Mahwah, New Jersey now. I can verify the hyperhydration problem. One of the common techniques for overcoming altitude sickness when you're hiking at altitude is to hydrate a bit more than normal. My one son took that to a bit of an extreme, and I literally watched him probably return 2 quarts of water at about 10,500 feet. We had started the day at about 7,000 feet. So, you know, probably 11,000 feet, 11,000 feet. So, we've gone up about 3,800 feet during the day, and so he was sipping water pretty aggressively, I guess. And we got to where we were going, and all of a sudden he turned nauseous, and boom, out it came. He looked like kind of the Clearwater version of the scene for The Exorcist. It didn't have that pea soup quality. It was clear, but it was very impressive. He looked like a fire hydrant. Anyway, with that pleasant note, I'll set...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Comment on that, Dick?
Yeah, John recognized. First of all, Gordon, what happened to make your son... What happened to make his body decided that water had to leave? There was too much of it, and the body said had to get rid of it, or the change in altitude, or maybe he had some other sickness at the time. Give us a couple of words as to why the water came back, Eric. There you go. Gordon, W2TTT, K2RIW.
It was just too much water. He probably had five or six quarts of water in a world where he really needed to have three or four. He probably only needed three or four.
as he ascended 3,800 feet on a hiking trail in New Mexico.
Yeah, well, somewhat similar to what happens again to college students when they consume too much alcohol. And sometimes the body gives it back, and be awful thankful it does, because alcohol poisoning is a nasty way to die. And without the body saying, hey, that's too much of that stuff, and the body gives it back to the world, in many cases that's a survival technique, and thank goodness it takes place. John wanted to make a comment on this. KC2WGB, K2RW, the tech man.
Yeah, Dick, a lot of the high altitude sickness is due to, and the regurgitated water or fluids is because of the gas that develops inside of the body because of the lower pressure. That's another issue, and it's a pretty serious issue for some of the climbers.
Absolutely, I'll confirm that. But it is a technique to in altitude as a way to combat the effects of increased altitude. The problem is if you overdo it, then you get that regurgitation problem. So, yeah, I can tell you it really does happen. My son was 15 years old, the number two son. Anyway, very good. By the way, we're on the side of Mount Baldy in Philmont Scout Ranch, for those who might care. WG2TTT. Sounds like a really pretty area to visit, Gordon. And I know you guys and your family do quite a bit of mountaineering from time to time. Smarter people, you take better vacations than we do, if you know what I mean. But as I was starting to say, I asked Manfred in Chile, in the South American country of Chile, where he's working at the National Radio Astronomy, at the European Southern Observatory. I asked him to ask his fellow engineers, and by the way, because it is so difficult to get to the top of that mountain where the European Southern Observatory is located, that what people do is they work 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. You spend half a day traveling there. You get up to that mountain. You dwell there for 2 weeks. Then you come back down for another 2 weeks at normal sea level, if you know what I mean. That was his working experience, as well as all the other people, because it takes so long to travel. You don't commute to that place every day already. So each breakfast morning, he's got a chance to talk to these people. And I started giving him a couple of puzzles to ask his people to find out, is there a difference in the European-educated answer versus the American-educated answer? The results were striking. Let me drop it. First of all, I had him ask the first question, what is the weight, what is the mass of a cubic meter of air? And most of them said, what the hell do I want to know that for? They said that in German or Swedish or whatever, but that was the answer. Why would I want to know that? And there's a couple of very good reasons why you'd want to know it. The second question I had them ask was, what was that one, the other one? I think it was the birds in the truck puzzle. Anyhow, as he asked these engineers these puzzle questions, most of the engineers I worked with, two-thirds of them, would meet me in the hall and say, hey, Dick, what's the puzzle of the day? And I'd give them one of those puzzles. And they'd go away with a smile on their face, and they'd go tell their buddies. One quarter of the guys didn't like the puzzles. They felt intimidated by them. They'd see me coming down the hall, and they'd turn a corner to make sure they didn't run into me face-to-face. For fear that I'd give them one of those puzzles. There's a certain kind of engineer that cannot tolerate the fact that somebody asks him a question for which it sounds like a logical question, but he doesn't have an answer. The Americans, a certain small percentage of American engineers respond in that manner. Let me drop. Okay, so by the time he asked the second one of my puzzles to his European, highly educated engineers at the breakfast table on the top of the mountain in Chile, at the European Southern Observatory, their response was they took their car keys out of their pockets and threw them at him and said, don't do that anymore. That amazed me. In other words, those particular engineers, the majority of the European engineers in that facility, could not tolerate being asked a puzzle for which they didn't have an immediate answer, and when the answer was given to them, they didn't like it. They didn't like the fact that Mother Nature's physics was so foreign to their common sense, so to speak, and they didn't have an answer that's even in the right ballpark. When the average American engineer
gives an answer for the weight of a cubic meter of air of 1 milligram, and the answer is 1.2 kilograms. They're 1,000 to 1 wrong. I mean, to miss a problem by 50%, you're in the ballpark. When you're 1,000 to 1 wrong, 3 orders of magnitude wrong, there's something going on here. I mean, you're up. And at first you would say, hey, this is academic. Why the hell would anybody want to know that? Okay? If you're a pilot of Flight 587 and 285 people are about to die, and you don't know the mass of a cubic meter of air, and you don't know what's really going on with that 747 heavy that just took off 5 minutes ahead of you, and you're about to fly the exact same path directly behind him, you're about to encounter multiple times the horizontal cyclones coming off the tips of those wings, and that in turn is going to create such a ridiculously high force to the vertical stabilizer of your airplane, your 767, that it rips off that carbon graphite reinforced vertical stabilizer, rips it off the airplane. The airplane ended up flying sideways at 200 and some odd knots, and the force of the wind hitting the aircraft sideways ripped both engines off of that aircraft, and it's got a missing rudder, and both engines are off the airplane before it struck the ground. First time in history. The lack of knowledge of what is the weight of a cubic meter of air was a strong contributing factor to that accident, in my opinion. Knowledge, no matter how crazy it is, if you absorb it, understand it, it looks like we're being cut off. There's more to the story. Sorry, we have to cut you off this time. You just heard TechNet number...
You just heard TechNet number 1463. Sorry to say we got cut off at exactly midnight at my request. John, I'm pretty sure you have a way of coming through the Eastern input to say your comments. There's more to follow to the story, but you've heard a little bit of the leading edge of it. KC2WGB, thank you, and WS2N, thank you. Bye-bye, you guys. We tend to be back next week, and we'll settle more of these issues. We're going to get smarter. KC2WGB, for any other comments, K2RIW. Bye-bye, John.
Comment.
Thank you, GreatNet. I want to thank Jay and the guys who sent in the questions, and the people who sent in the pictures. Fun that, and we love it. And we'll be back next week, God willing, and we'll carry on. So, best to everybody out there. I don't know what happened to Wesley tonight, who we didn't hear from. This is KC2WGB. We'll be on the side.
73, John. And maybe next week we'll get to the survival of the astronauts going to Mars, Dick. The possibilities of that. 73, GreatNet. Have a good night. WS2, I'm clear.
Paul, I think Dick wants to cut it to the bottom line, you know, like, let's just send a corpse there and get it over with.
It's quite that bad, but it's almost that bad. I think I heard another person other than Paul and John. Was somebody else on this frequency asking a quickie question? Go ahead. Okay, I heard somebody, YDY. I'm not sure you've got a PL turned on. Let me drop it. I'm not sure you're running a 4ZPL. I'm hearing you on the input, but I'm not hearing you on the output. YDY, start off with your name and your question or comment. KQLIW. So what Hank just said is that there was a lot of training going on, and pilots are being trained as to how to respond to wingtip vortices, wake vortices. The pilot was blamed for pilot error. He's no longer alive to defend himself. There's a hell of a lot more to that story, Hank. Are you saying that we should allow to fly in American airspace an airplane that if you overuse the rudder, you can rip the rudder off the airplane and create that kind of a crash and 587 people die, and it's just a matter of training the pilot? Much too simplistic. When you look at the FAA records for that exact serial number airplane, you'll find out that when Airbus shipped it to the United States, it arrived with a significant horizontal crack to the vertical stabilizer to that graphite-reinforced material. What the United States engineers did was to drill a hole above and below the crack, screw down a piece of sheet metal on the back side inside the rudder as a way of trying to reestablish the strength of those vertical strands of the carbon-reinforced material. They would test it periodically by knocking on it with their knuckles. You also look into the
the records of the aircraft, you find out it had a tail strike onto a concrete runway on three occasions before this accident. You also find that that aircraft experienced clear air turbulence over Europe so severe that it put passengers and flight crew in the hospital. So that aircraft had one hell of a chunk of history. None of that was in the NTSB report. N1YDY, teacher IW in the tech man. Yeah, very fine, Hank. The biggest mistake, as I see it, that the pilot made was to not wait the right number of minutes before the takeoff. He took off too soon, flew exactly the same path below and under the 747 Heavy. He probably thought that the FAA's recommendation for X number of minutes of delay of takeoff was just the FAA being conservative. He had gotten clearance to take off, but he's the commander of the ship, and he took off much too soon. And with the particular wind conditions that day, he flew directly into those wakes two or three times. So I hear tell that the flight deck recorder recorded the sounds of those encounters of that wake. He really should have waited another minute or two to take off, and all of that accident, I think, wouldn't have occurred. So there was a number of errors in that whole incident, as I see it. N1YDY, K2LAW. Yeah, I think it was 287 people, flight 587. And yeah, very good information on that error chain that you described. A lot of things all went wrong in that particular day. A lot of lessons to be learned. Thank you for the additional information, Hank. And we better sign off. Bye-bye for now, and see you guys next week. Thank you all. K2LAW.
Echo 3, Victor, Echo 3, Juliet, India, Whiskey, Toronto.
I think I'm hearing Victor, Echo 3, Juliet, Echo, Whiskey, in Toronto. Go ahead, K2RIW.
Yes, thank you so much. A challenge to get in the tiny gap. It is Victor, Echo 3, Juliet, India, Whiskey. I think of air as 13 cubic feet per pound. Sort of the SAE unit. A question you could modify, one is, if you took a bag of helium and filled an empty transport semi with that helium, would it be cheaper to pull down the road because it would be lighter? And I was thinking in terms of chemicals, but I didn't get in earlier. Is there a particular chemical that we didn't have? We'd be a being, but we wouldn't have memories, or we'd have very poor mental ability if there was a chemical element missing in our environment. Anyway, it's a fun net.
Very fine, Jim. PE3JIW, K2LIW. So you think of 13 cubic feet of air as opposed to... I thought much of Canada is on the metric system. I'm a little bit surprised you don't think of it in cubic meters. Cubic meter, 1.2 kilograms is air at the standard temperature and pressure. And, without a doubt, there's all kinds of individual nutraceuticals or whatever that you take them out of the diet and you're going to suffer all kinds of disadvantages. When it comes to long-term, when it comes to short-term survival, though, the rule of threes, 3 minutes, 3 days, 3 weeks for air, water, food, is the immediate answer that you could give. Of course, it's naive, but... in the case of the recovery of people from collapsed buildings in Oklahoma, here we go, in Mexico City, 1985, I mean, some significant number of days downrange, as long as the person did have air and water, he survived. And so real survival out at sea or in a collapsed building, sometimes relatively small things make the big difference between life and death. And so... Any of the specifics to discuss that I think is useful. Over to you, Jim. B3JIW, K2LIW.
Think metrics, but that figure wasn't something from school. It just came up in a discussion. You know, in one of those things, you know, figuring out something for some reason, the weight of air becomes interesting. But no, you had a fun net. I actually listened on streaming most through the night. So. Not going to drag it later because it is after midnight. but again, I did see National Geographic on that flight crash. I didn't hear about